Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Today, the Contract Masters join us to talk about their work helping people get out of debt and bad contracts. But first, a big thank you to the listeners, the hosts, producers, and staff of WBAI who stepped up to help the station meet its fundraising goals. Thank you very much. Here's a story in other news that connects back to a interview that we did in January and last fall with investigative journalist Stacy Lynn. She's the one who exposed how taxpayer money in the Fort Collins area of Colorado was being spent annually and wasted. She saved about 300 local jobs, a lot of private businesses, by bringing awareness to ICLEI policies that were to be mainly voted on in secret. And ICLEI stands for International Council of Local Environmental Initiatives. She also exposed the solar power company Abound for taking government money, then declaring bankruptcy. And here's a story that just came out on Fox News. Bankrupt solar panel firm took stimulus money, left a toxic mess, says report. A Colorado-based solar company that got hundreds of millions of dollars in federal loan guarantees before going belly up didn't just empty taxpayers' wallets. It left behind a toxic mess of carcinogens, broken glass, and contaminated water, according to a new report. The Abound solar plant, which got $400 million in federal loan guarantees in 2010 when the Obama administration sought to use stimulus funds to promote green energy, filed for bankruptcy 2 years later. Now its Longmont, Colorado facility sits unoccupied. It's 37,000 square feet littered with hazardous waste, broken glass, and contaminated water. The Northern Colorado Business Report estimates it will cost up to $3.7 million to clean and repair the building so it can again be leased. Well, the owner of the property tried to force a bankruptcy trustee to clean the facility, but the report said it would place humans at imminent and significant health risks. One of the hazards is the presence of cadmium, a cancer-causing agent used to produce the film on the solar panels. That's according to the report. But listeners, remember connecting back to what Stacy Lynn had exposed, the woman who owned this company, Abound Solar Manufacturing, was retaliating against Stacy Lynn for exposing the budget in the Fort Collins area, Colorado, connected to UN Agenda 21 in ICLEI. You see the connections here. President Obama touted Abound Solar Power Company in July of 2010, announcing its $2 billion investment in green energy projects. Abound Solar Manufacturing manufactured advanced solar panels at two new plants, creating more than 2,000 construction jobs and 1,500 permanent jobs, Obama said. But less than 2 years later, the company laid off half of its 400 workers, then in the summer of 2012, filed for bankruptcy. It became the third clean energy company to seek bankruptcy protection after receiving a loan from the Energy Department under the Economic Stimulus Law. What this particular article is pointing out is that it's touted as being clean energy, but these solar panel makers are leaving behind millions of pounds of toxic sludge and contaminated water, but they're also taking off with the money. Stacy Lynn, whose story is so complicated, full of twists and turns, had exposed Patricia Stryker, who owned Abound Solar Company. She also exposed how a huge web of financial interaction funding ICLEI through shell companies abuse and waste taxpayer money. Well, since 2008, there's been no shortage of foreclosure stories and how good people are being forced out of their homes. In fact, a story last month titled Foreclosure Vampires in New Jersey describes people living in their homes during a drawn-out foreclosure process as vampires, squatters, or freeloaders. These are people who are caught in lawsuits or the mortgage company will not accept payment, and the process is dragging out. However, the language being used to describe this reality is quite interesting. The people are vampires, yet they're trying to pay their bills. Our guests today might suggest that the bankers are the real vampires, or the system itself is siphoning off the life energy out of the national human capital. Jakarta, Zoe, and Jake and Willies have created a company called The Art of Knowing, and within that company, they run a business called Contract Masters. They help people get out from under foreclosures, car and credit card payments, and other forms of contractual debt. They begin by redefining the terms being applied by the banks and legal system that often lead us to assumptions, such as what is the original meaning of mortgage? What is the difference between lawful and legal? That's just the beginning. Jakarta began as a bounty hunter and published a book titled The Seekers, A Bounty Hunter's Story. We start there with what I suspect will be the first part of a series of interviews. Jakarta and Jake, and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
You bet. All right, we'll start now with Jakarta about your book. You were a bounty hunter earlier in your life. You wrote a book about some of your more harrowing cases titled The Seekers, A Bounty Hunter's Story. Tell us about that experience.
There was a case that touched me pretty deep. It was a young man who had got addicted to heroin, and his parents had put their property up to get him out on a bond. But they wouldn't help the police capture him after he jumped bond. He had later on, committed some burglaries in the area because he needed to feed his fix. I had spent probably about 2 weeks canvassing the area trying to get someone to connect with, but he stayed on the move. And then one day I got a call from his grandmother, and she invited me by, and we talked, and she said, "Well, you know, you seem to be a fair man. I'm going to give you some ideas, some areas to maybe you can look for." So she gave me the name of a girlfriend and what she was driving.
Where was this?
This was actually in Long Branch, New Jersey, but he would travel from Long Branch to Newark, New Jersey. He was actually living out of a car at the time. And his girlfriend had the addiction as well, so they lived out of a car. So they would do little burglaries, and then they would shoot to Newark, buy their goods, and then, you know, go to a motel. So one day she called me. She gave me the car and the description of the girlfriend and her name. I had some pretty strong street contacts, and someone called me up and says, "Well, that car is here." I followed the car because I didn't want to do it right there because I didn't want to blow my cover in the area. And he went to an hotel and gave him some time to settle in. And then once I went in, he forgot to lock the door behind him. So he was so in a panic, on a rush to get the drug that he just went in with the girl. And I went in right after, and he was sitting on the bed with the hypodermic needle still sticking out of his neck because she was giving him a shot. And so when I walked in with a mask on and a pistol, it was like he saw a ghost.
Just to clarify, the mask is just over your mouth, right?
Right.
And so you can see your eyes.
Right.
And you have a hat on.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
Baseball cap backwards.
Normally either a tight, special fitted skull cap or and then the face, you know, partially covered.
Okay. So it's not like a mask that covers everything.
Right. Okay. That's right. That's right. A partial mask. So he stopped. She looked at me, ran into the bathroom, left him there on the bed with the needle still hanging out of his neck. As I began to approach him to let him know that it wasn't a robbery, that he was going to jail, she peeked out the bathroom, came out. He asked me, "How did I find him?" He wanted to know, "How did you find me?" And I never told him, and I never do. I never tell where I get the information from. But he asked me to do him a favor. Normally people don't ask for favors at that particular point in time. He asked me to take the girl back home and to be sure that I help her get into a rehab, that he wanted her away from him, that he had tried his best to keep her away from him, but she was, insistent on being with him. And that really struck me hard, that he would be still concerned about pushing her away from him to help try to save her, I guess.
To
Yes, to protect. And so that was really striking to me at the time.
This is one of the cases that's in this book, The Seekers.
Yes.
What did you begin to learn about the legal system and individuals that you were sent to pick up?
Well, the legal system is very interesting because as I afforded myself the time to look and do more research, I found that there was something different about the legal and the lawful system. There's a legal system and a lawful system. And the lawful system seemed to bring more balance because someone would step up and be responsible in a lawful situation. In a legal situation, it was about moving the paper and identifying the person on the paper, not really getting into the heart and soul of the person. So what if I saw someone with a rap sheet for armed robbery, that's all he could ever be, was that, because that's what his rap sheet said. So the legal system is pretty cold sometimes. It doesn't bend like a lawful system would bend. And so being engaged in that, I was able to spend some time with a judge who had asked me, what are you going to do when you finally finish gunslinging? He's called me a gunslinger, but he was a good guy, beautiful man. And so we eventually wind up connecting up, and he took me to certain places to expose to me how systems work. And that is when I really begin to understand the legal system and how sometimes it could be very, very cold and very unforgiving when it comes to dealing with people.
I suspect that that may have led you into some of the work that you're doing now. Before we get into that, did you begin to see the people that you were picking up differently after a while?
I had never prejudged, and that was a promise I made to my dad, that I wouldn't prejudge anyone at any given time, that I would stay completely open and flexible to see the individual not for what they were doing, but for possibly what they could evolve into. And I made that promise to him early on when I started to do the work. And that was probably because of his past. So I never judged. So I saw them the same the first day I met them to the day that I dropped them off at the county or wherever. I saw them the very same. I was able to get into the essence of who they were and speak to them soul to soul. And so I really never judged. I never judged.
This is Jake, and I just wanted to interject something here. That scene you had, I mean, moved me, and I'm sure it moves the audience, that you saw him as not a piece of paper, but as a human, and like you, and not unlike you, like the rap sheet would tell you. And that scenario that's moving, I mean, it moved me. And then everyone that you looked at that would had the rap sheet, you would look at it a different way. The legal system is confining. The lawful system is open. So that's an open to interpretation. So, I mean, it moved me. I mean, I'm sure that was profound for you, that the next bounty you were after wasn't actually a bounty.
Well, you know, at one time, and even now, and you and I, we say it a lot together, Jake, and in our constant conversations, that there go, but for the grace of the Creator, there go I. Sure. And so that is something that my mom told me, that, just be cognizant that, those that you encounter, that could have been you, and it could have been someone else wearing the mask.
Right.
And you could have been the one,
appearing as the bounty.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I'm glad you used that word, because that's what it was. These individuals were appearing as something. And then when I finally got past the rap sheet and saw them for who they are, that appearance melted away. I saw a young man, probably 22 years of age, who had, pus running from his arm, not taking care of himself at all, came from a great family, South Jersey, great family. And he was broken.
Running out of options because he was using his neck where normally you would use your arm.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
This is one example of some of the people that you're picking up. And were all of them young men? And what were you able to see as a larger pattern about these young people that you were picking up?
Well, it was really an array of people, all different ages, no seniors, of course. But what I saw, the pattern I saw, was the fact that somehow we had gotten, we collectively, species, had gotten off the track. Somewhere along the lines, we were beginning to create these characters, maybe through our movies, maybe through the raising in the individual families. We were all role-playing. I mean, somehow, from early on, we were given these roles to play, and sometimes we fell into roles. You know, I always tried to see the soul and the spirit, you know, first and foremost. Of course, I also felt that made me safe. If I could touch you beyond the physical, I feared you less. If I could touch you soul to soul, there was no threat there. There was no fear there.
You weren't alone.
I wasn't alone, absolutely.
Now, Jakarta, that's one part of your life. You've got a family, and you continue to do very interesting work that's helping individuals get out from under difficult financial situations involving contract law. You and Jake and Willies have created a partnership called The Art of Knowing. And again, we're joined by Jakin right now as well. Tell us about this company, Jakarta, and how you got started.
Well, really, it was a culmination of years in the making. I mean, we could almost say from the time we met, it was actually formulating itself better than 10 years ago.
Yeah, it was the turn of the century, and it basically it's a continuing conversation that bells and whistles were going off when we met, because my discipline is, you could describe it as esoteric, and his is very specific in law. And when we met, my friend saying we had to meet. So when we did meet, we were stunned. I was stunned, I'll speak for myself, that our research, although very different in discipline, was coming to the same conclusion. So in other words, our investigation is into cause. It's a study of cause, not effect, although we have sympathy with effect, like the gentleman with the needle in his neck. We have sympathy with the effects, but we're more interested in the cause of the archetypical appearance of the characters in the contract.
Jake, take us through a situation where somebody comes to you with a financial problem. Say, for example, they're over their head on a mortgage and they're in debt. Give us an example of how you've helped people.
Well, again, to look at the cause of the problem, which is the mortgage and a non-payment and threatened to take the home, we look at the cause of, and we want an assessment of the loan. In other words, the loan has caused it to be, whether it's in derivatives or not. The source of the problem is the loan. So we look into the cause of the loan. All we always ask for is the assessment of the loan. The loan was actually never made. So you're invested in a loan, in a mortgage, and paying interest on it over the years, of course, of 30 years, maybe paying 3.5 times the house is worth over that period. And if you fall short, the bank takes the house. Well, the bank never put up any money, lost any money to begin with. So we look at the cause, and all the derivatives that are trying to collect the house, because they broke the note into many pieces, there is no note anymore, they're all trying to take the house and try in varying ways. But if we look at the essence of the loan, we see that there was no loss to begin with, or we would say, where's the injured party? So the bank never shows up in court. That's why they're released. That's why they stay in the house. I would always say, don't leave the house. Do not leave the house. It's your house. It is your house. The loan was never real.
I would really like to add to that, because he's absolutely correct on that. When we are able to have open communications in writing with the responsible parties who feel as though maybe something had been done or some act performed, when you begin to look at the words that created that nexus, is where you begin to get the relief. Debt is in the mind. It is in the mind. We somehow believe as though we can be bound by a fiction to a responsibility based upon our signature. and in most cases signing something that we have no understanding of. That's probably one of the most critical keys is, do you understand what you're signing? You know, I'm in my 50s, and my mom used to always get on my dad about, and this is strange how we go back with this, about, you know, why he never wanted to, you know, buy a new car. He always said, when I walk away with it, I pay cash for it, I save for it, and it's mine. I don't want someone chasing me around. I don't want to have to take my car and masquerade it or put a costume on it and dress my car up like a horse and put it in the field so they can't repossess it. I feel comfortable with saving for it and waiting to be able to truly pay for it and not having to sign a contract and go through these kind of things. Now, he was a country guy. He really never signed anything. If he couldn't afford it, he just didn't buy it.
This is voluntary, and the loss is not real. So, again, the debt that we're paying on the mortgage, to get back to your question, to say economics warfare is redundancy, economics is warfare, okay? So the loss is imagined. The mortgagee agrees to the imagined debt, and then he is invested in his own debt, but it is fictional. So the payment over the years, we released someone from a mortgage at one point, and I forget how long ago this was, but I was it was around Thanksgiving, and I had told my brother, who's in finances, and I told him the story. And his question to me was, okay, you got them out. They're in the house. The bank's off their back. Where do they send their mortgage payments?
I want to go into more detail here and how you release people from these contracts. And Jakarta, you were describing a while back to me an elderly woman who was drowning in debt with a mortgage. I want to go into that. I want to mention this. I recently read about how if you buy a home outright, similar to what you were just saying, Jake, if you buy a home outright, say for $75,000, you pay that amount to the bank. No more is added to that price. However, when you enter into a contract with the bank to pay off the home, for example, you give a down payment and have mortgage payments for about 36 months, you do the math, which is to multiply the monthly payment by the number of months and compare that number to the initial cost of the home. Sometimes you're looking at three times the cost of the home.
We've been trained, I believe, to want the thing by any means necessary. We want the thing without looking at the specifics of what it takes in order to acquire the thing. So if I tell you that I can give you a brand new Mercedes-Benz or a home, and all you had to do was sign this contract, chances are if I put the keys to the house and the keys to the car on the table in front of you, your mind registers that you want the thing, but not the responsibility of the language that goes into the contract that binds you to those things. One of the things that's evident about contracts is that there needs to be full disclosure in those contracts, and there needs to have the elements of truthfulness. There must be clean hands when entering into an arrangement or agreement with someone going into a contract. Well, if I start out as a loan originator, originating a loan for you, and I'm not clearly stating that I'm the lender, I'm the loan originator, and I engage you with this contract, and you enter into it, and then somehow 2 or 3 months later, someone else is saying, well, you need to send your payments over here, and the interest rates have gone up, and maybe you're behind because you sent that last payment to the last loan originator, but we're the new servicer on that mortgage now. We're creating something called bifurcation, where you take something that starts out together and it separates itself and it begins to morph into these many different things. Well, this one lady, she had a bifurcated arrangement set up for her. And all we pretty much did was just ask for someone from the servicer to put us in contact with the actual lender and to give us some details about if the note and the mortgage were still together, who was really the lender or the damaged party, as Jakin had said earlier, and can we negotiate with them? They sent a letter back stating, A, the notice of intent to foreclose had been rescinded on this woman, and that what they wanted to do was sit down and negotiate. And so she wound up getting an extremely sweetheart deal because when the administrative way of requesting information from them regarding the ownership of the note and the mortgage was sent to them, and they refused to give the information because either they didn't have it or they just didn't want to surrender it. One representative of the loan services stated that they would send a form that they would request that we subpoena those records. And we're saying, well, why are we going there with this? Give us the documents so we can begin to move this thing forward. Well, someone in charge from the servicer contacted her and said, listen, forget about past conversations. Forget about what happened. This is a deal that we're willing to offer you. And they took her mortgage from $2,100 to $980 a month. They reduced her interest rate. And pretty much they were saying, if you do this with us now, the past is done. We want to see you stay in this home. We know you love this home. We want to work with you. And so that was a sweetheart deal for her.
We're the good guys.
We're speaking with Jakata Zoe and Jakin Willis, who run the business called Contract Masters, helping people get out of debt. We'll be right back after this break. Just joining us, we're talking with Jakata Zoe and Jakin Willis, who have a company that helps people get out of debt.
When we begin to see that we need to take time to really look at what debt is and what we have engaged in, and really begin to break the words down that tie us to the fantasy, is where the relief comes in at. The greatest help that I think beyond saving someone's property or helping them with credit cards or moving them to an affiliate or a trained affiliate to do certain things is the mind, the ease of pressure once you understand the condition is the first effect of debt relief. You cannot separate the relief from the mind of the pressure from the actual monetary gain that you get in the negotiations. Because it's really the pressure that we're seeing that's breaking up families, that have people giving up. We know people who have walked away from their homes without even receiving a foreclosure notice. Just because they were 6 months behind, they left the keys in the mailbox and they left their homes.
You're saying the psychological abstract pressure in the mind is creating a lot of frustration in families and individuals.
So the abstraction is that the loan that we talked about before wasn't actually given. There was no loss to the bank. It was actually a gain to the bank. It wasn't a loss. That belief that it is a loss and a debt that must be invested in and paid interest on is a system of unknowing. In other words, you don't know that there's no loss. The bank doesn't know there's no loss because they see it as a gain, right? So this is all in the mind. So you've accepted the debt. We could go even further and say, why does she have to earn a living? is she alive or is she not? So when you said abstract, I jumped in because we always joke. He's very specific. I'm very abstract. So that's what the conversation was about for 5 hours on the first day. So we saw a correlation between what we are both doing. The mortgagee is misinformed. The bank is also misinformed. So there's an unknowing that's going on there that we are actually investing in not knowing. We're invested in not knowing. Could not knowing be valuable?
Jakin's motivation to me in regards to the way that I communicate now is because of just that one point. After communicating with these entities, and we don't view the banks as being bad. We don't view the individual in debt as being bad. We don't see bad and good in this. What we see is unknowing. It is a sheer fact that we do not know what we're engaging in that binds us to this play. Debtors, creditors, borrowers, lenders, these are titles. These are things that are created to hold us into a certain thought pattern, and that is what's causing the pain out there, that thought pattern.
It's the source. When you seek the cause, you see the source is imagined. So the effects go with that. Now, we can prove that very specifically, but it's also abstract. It is also a general truth. The truth sets you free. The truth is you are free. We've enslaved ourselves. We cannot be bound except by our own beliefs.
Right. That's heavy. I'm glad you pointed that out, Jake. Now, I want some more examples of how you've specifically helped individuals, regular people, get out from under these particular contracts and financial problems.
You know, one of the key functions of the Institute of the Art of Knowing and Contract Masters is that in order for you to move to that next level of being free or debt free, you must purge yourself of certain thoughts and you must learn the material to free yourself. Now, we can guide you, and we guide a lot of people into a better understanding on how that works. But we don't directly try to offer a service in where you can dump your reservoir or debt onto us to try to figure out for you. What we try to do is enlighten you to the matrix of how it all works and guide you on how to resolve it. The reason being, if I help you understand what it is and guide you along the way, you're going to take the same knowledge and pass this on to your daughter and to your son. So if I help you and I do it all for you, 99% of the work for you, then you may be relieved of that pressure. But what about those coming behind you? You know, what about your son with the student loan issue? What about your daughter with the credit card issue because she loves shopping at Macy's? What about them?
Student loans. You hear a lot about students graduating from universities saddled with debt. Some won't pay off these loans for 15, 20 years.
It's the pre-mortgage mortgage.
Are you helping students as well?
Students pick up on this quite fast because of, I got to refer back to Jenkins' side that he brings to this, where he speaks about those who have less to unlearn. So where we may be seasoned and conditioned into believing a certain kind of way, under that premise, they learn and can see clearer on how to resolve these issues. And again, it comes back from communicating. If you know how to communicate with these alleged creditors, you can resolve these issues very easily if you learn how to communicate with them. Stop seeing them as just gigantic evil or the devilish banks. And it's really not about them and their alleged power. It's about having the understanding to communicate with them, and they will relieve you. They will relieve you from that debt, but you have to help them help you.
It has to be a will to know. It has to be a will to know. If you have no will to know, you don't have a problem, so you don't come to us in the first place. So you have to perceive a problem first. So if you don't, and you're content of the way things are, you won't come to us. But if there is a perceived problem, we look at the cause of the problem with the member. And it's not the Jakin effect. It's the continuing conversation of that will to know what the cause is and to remedy it. We have to have the will to remedy it, but you have to see a problem first.
Tell listeners about the success rate of your work within Contract Masters in helping people.
The success rate is really based upon how one, again, would gauge what success is. If success is that you sleep better at night because you are now able to communicate with these entities, credit card companies, mortgage companies, that you're able to now communicate in full disclosure and clarity, then that success rate would be 100% because the problem, again, starts in the mind. And once you get that under control and you begin to understand the language being used to bind you, then you have success.
See, these contracts are all voluntary, so you are the one that signed it, implemented it. It's a form. There's no other signature on it. It's not a legal contract. You're voluntarily entering into a fictional contract. So if we teach our members that they started the fire that is the problem and they put it out, they're not afraid of fire.
Going back to the story about your father, and I think that's very interesting. Can you elaborate a little bit more on paying for something outright?
Right. It's the whole premise of being able to be patient enough to acquire or take possession of things that you really feel that you want, and being patient. That's what my dad taught me. It was just, you know, be patient. You know, when I was working, doing the investigative work, I had a tendency to want to go out and buy things when I was younger. And he said, you know what, there's going to come a day where you are going to begin to deplete your finances, and you're going to look around in your apartment or your house, and you're going to say, well, you know what, I could really do without 90% of the stuff that's in here. And I swear I wish I had that money in the bank now. So as I begin to acquire a few things, I slow down and I begin to say, do I really need that right now? And chances are, if I gave myself a couple of days, I didn't spend the money and I didn't buy it. So if we could get back to that point to where you don't run out and go get the $700 pair of shoes or the, you know, $5,000 stereo system, you wait, chances are you're going to be more happy and more solid in your finances with it sitting somewhere else than catching dust because a new model just came out and you want to get rid of that Bang & Olufsen system. Now you want to get a different system because you want to upgrade. His lesson to me was just be patient, wait, and acquire it, buy it, save for it.
Uncertainty is ended with knowledge. So if you know, you're not uncertain and the fear is gone. So it's patience that your father taught you very well, I might add, is key in this.
And that is also getting into the power of marketing and how almost every particular facet of human psychology has been mapped out so they know exactly what area to target and press those buttons within you so you are making these irrational purchases with funds that you don't have.
Right.
And then you enter into these contracts without really knowing what's going
on. Economic warfare. Yes, we enter into the warfare. To stop and think and look and know is key in not moving in fear. And it's a game of warfare. So in warfare, you're looking to be allayed, not for like we saw with our friend with a needle in his neck. He joined with him in the sympathy of that character. So we're not looking to separate from that character. We're drawing near to it. So in non-fear, we wouldn't purchase the object to compete with the other enemy. And we get to, this is the point we're trying to enter into now, is that there is no enemy in the contract or the form that you're signing. We're not fighting anyone. We're signing the form voluntarily, and we're implementing our own misery, if we're having a misery, and something that needs to be corrected. So again, once we learn that we have implemented it and we can remedy it by opting out of it, then we lose our fear, then we stop purchasing through fear, like you're saying with advertising, is fear. If you don't have this, you won't get the girl, and you're not going to get the car, and you're not going to get the house, and oh my God, what's going to happen then?
Right. The identity is linked into the product.
Right. We can slow the mind down. This is all in the mind, again, like Jakarta said. This is in the mind. Everything pre-presumption. The contract is a presumption that you're signing into. It's a form, so it's a presumption. If you don't look at the form and read the form, you're signing on to a presumption that has already been there before you signed it, right? So it's like we were talking about before. We've created a form that we're dissatisfied with. It's a form that everybody's holding in the appearance. So what we're questioning in the appearance is, do we want the form? So that's what we're doing here right now. I mean, this is a continuing conversation. This is what Plato was talking about. Who am I and what is my function? So this is abstract, yes. It's deep, yes. But how deep and limitless is our mind together when we come together? Well, we found it's limitless.
When these individuals come to you with debt and they want to get rid of this debt, but then you hit them with this abstract philosophy, what are some of the responses you get?
Ah!
Well, you know, can I go?
Sure,
the tremendous amount of relief, because the guilt that you carry from being in debt or being lesser than, or, you know, as a good friend of mine who had came to me about a year ago, you know, he was making a six-figure salary, you know, three vacations a year, you know, including Disney. And he felt like the man in the family. I mean, he felt really good about himself. But then when he lost his job and he got the foreclosure notice after living off a credit card for almost a year and a half, what relieved him was not that I shared with him some letter exhibits on how to deal with the creditors. It was the fact that I extracted the guilt from him, and when he saw the nexus and the creation of the debt, he was in tears. He said, because I was asleep when I acquired these things. You know, when my wife said she wanted to upgrade to the Lexus next model, I went out and did it. When the iPads and all this stuff came out, I went out and bought them. You know, not one, but four and five, you know, because I was making that kind of money. He said, now I have a house full of gadgets, no money, and I'm at peace, because once, you know, you and Jakin, you know, laid it out for me to help me understand what I had engaged in, now remedy begins. Now the remedy begins. Now I can begin to not just correct the problem, but never have this problem again.
Well, guilt and debt are the same word. They're not different. We've created a system, an economic system, again, economic warfare, that is, its predicate is debt. Federal Reserve note is a debt note. We're agreeing to it and then suffering the consequences of the debt. So once we realize that we're doing this, that I have done this. All I do unto myself. It's an empowerment. You might not want to admit it. You know, you might want to blame it on someone else and have an enemy. But that would be maintaining the fictional contract in the form. So this is why we do the work we do. We release both parties, the bank and the mortgagee, from the contract. They're both free of an assumed debt.
That was a good example. And that explanation is really interesting. And I have not looked at it in that sense, in that perspective. Where do you see the U.S. economy moving toward now and through the lens of the work that you do?
Sometimes when you hit a bad spot, it's a good spot because it gives us the chance to examine the whole spot. People are beginning to grasp that there's something fundamentally wrong with the way that they're thinking. If somehow we were able to print money for every household and made everyone a millionaire tomorrow, we would probably be drinking sand by the end of the week because there would be no more water, no more trees. We're at that point where we could turn this thing around, but we have to redefine our relationship to each other and to this thing called debt. So the U.S. economy is, as far as I'm concerned, is in a great place because it's in a place where we can now begin to analyze it for what it really is. A fiction.
Well, again, it's about an opportunity to see things the way they are. If there's a problem, and we all know there's a problem, the whole world's in debt. The question I would ask is, you know, how did we get into debt? And if we are in debt and the debt system is valuable, why do we have to bail out the top? So I'll answer my own question, is that there is no value in the system. There is no value in the system. Ben Bernanke might have a nice suit on. He's got his beard looks really well trimmed. But he's running a self-deception on himself.
Somebody sent me an email, and I didn't know if I'd be able to reference some of this, but it does come into play here. And he writes, what is national debt? I mean, literally, what is the definition of the words, the national debt? The United States of America is a registered corporation. The corporation enforces its own internal statutes and sometimes, quote, spends money to support physical projects such as building infrastructure or various implements of destruction. It has gotten way past the point of physically handing over some object of value in support of this government doing. For a short time, gold and silver were used as the medium of exchange. Then the FRNs, what's FRN?
Federal Reserve Notes.
Were printed and distributed. Now probably 90% of all, quote, energy transactions are just electronically typing numbers on a computer screen. What does it actually mean to say that we spent $500 billion for the destruction in Iraq? At that astronomical level, no actual physical representation of money is changing hands. It is all accomplished on a computer screen or some DOD employee printing some 9x11 sheets of paper.
Again, sympathy with the effects of the contract, of that physical contract. But the cause is fallacious. Of course, sympathy with the effects that happen because of it. But if we look back to the cause that we believe, invest, and pay interest on is false.
I want to thank Wayne for sending this in to me. He writes, if money started as a voluntary medium of value exchange between two willing people or two tribes, it was recently morphed into something that has almost no value or meaning at all. To say that the humans living within the imaginary borders or our imaginary country, quote, owe the government an additional $17 trillion is completely absurd and ridiculous. That is approximately $50,000 for every man, woman, and child.
This is the core of the Institute for the Art of Knowing. This is what the Art of Knowing is all about. You don't personalize debt. You don't personalize the government debt or your own personal debt. It shouldn't be personalized because the core, the source of its origin is not real. It's not real.
So we've created a fiction that is not working out. It doesn't matter if you're on the balance sheet, whether you're in the red or in the black. They're both fictions. Ms. Yellen, she has a balance sheet that's in her favor. In other words, the debt notes are made and stamped by the Federal Reserve, but they only produce debt notes. So how would you ever pay the interest? If they only print debt notes, every note is a debt note, how would you pay the interest on the debt? It's impossible. It's a rigged game. It's like Madoff. When they arrested him, they said, well, you ran a Ponzi scheme. You know, this Italian guy in the 20s ran a small game. International bankers are running the big game. So it's the same thing. There's no difference between the two.
You know, it's a hard concept to take hold. I understand what you're saying. Because normally you want to go to a financial advisor and he tells you, well, put some money here, pull it over here, draw from here, go there, put it there. You know, we'll put it in this trade or that stock or whatever, boom, boom. It almost seems as though we're afraid to look at source, that somehow we're afraid to look at the source of the problem, source of the debt, the source of the credit.
We are afraid to look at the source, and that's why we're getting paid through the system, the effect of the source. So we're all getting paid through. It's a brilliant disguise. I mean, I heard somebody say on the radio the other day, they said, this is either true or very elaborate ruse. And unfortunately, we're the rube. We all are the rube. And I'm talking about Ben Bernanke and me. We're all the rube in the system, but we're all getting paid through the system. So the question to cause, like Jakad is asking us to do, is difficult because we want to get paid. We want to get paid at the end of the day. You know, if we're all getting paid and collecting a paycheck on, hey, thank God it's Friday, we don't question the source of the payment. This is very basic, and I understand what you said before. that this is abstract. This is in the mind. But everything is abstract in the mind. Before you formulate the contract and before you sign it, there is thought involved. If there's not, then you can run into a problem. And then, hey, you never know. There's a commercial on now that I don't listen to. I don't have television, but I listen to radio, and there's a commercial on now, and a lot of commercials say, hey, you never know. You know, like the lottery. Like it could be a good thing. You know, like not knowing would be a good thing. Well, not knowing is uncertainty. Uncertainty is fear. So it's a fear system, and we all are looking for the paycheck at the end of the week.
I might add in, you never know is saying you'll never know. You never know.
It's a spell, yeah. And it's also a fear thought. It's a circular thought. Hey, if you never know, you are seeking, but you'll never find it. We are agreeing to the system that does that to us. We are agreeing to it. They're not doing it to us. Don't forget, we're signing the form voluntarily. We've implemented the system. We, the people, have implemented a system that is attacking us. Okay? So we've implemented a self-attack.
That's the hardest thing
to do. This is the hardest thing.
That's the hardest threshold. Yeah. You know, my friend who had the six-figure income, beautiful Mercedes, Lexus, South Jersey home, four-car garage, I mean, just a grand home. When he stepped back off of it and he saw the tremendous weight that was on his back for trying to maintain this lie, it almost killed him. So once he saw that he was the source, because at one time he was pissed off at Bank of America because they wouldn't talk to him, they wouldn't send him any documentation, they wouldn't help him figure out his problem, they wouldn't refinance. He had refinanced. They wouldn't do it again for the third or fourth time. He was mad at the banks. And then when he finally figured out, it's me, it's not them.
See, what we don't understand is the form that we're signing is implementing the attack that we've agreed upon. We're getting paid for it, but at what cost? You know, I think the Bible says the wages of sin is death. Well, the wages of fictional contract is debt. So to not have an enemy in the contract, in other words, somebody didn't do this to us, is to release both parties, the form, the system that you've created, and yourself who voluntarily signed it, are released at the same instant. So that is the magic of the work we do. We look at cause, and we're concerned with the effects and have sympathy with the effects. But if we look at the cause and the cause is fallacious, the effects go along with it. So we're free. You and I are free when we see our own self-deception. We have done this to ourselves. There is no enemy out there doing it to us. We have implemented a system that is a symptom of the thought. And the hardest thing, like Jakarta was saying, the hardest thing for our members to do and ourselves in this conversation since the turn of the century is to admit it to ourselves that the problems that I've encountered in my life, I'm the source of them. But it is also at the council table at the Art of Knowing, we understand that if I am the source of the problem, I am the solution.
Absolutely.
So that's the freeing part of it. It is fearful to look at it, to take the responsibility, but with the responsibility goes the power of initiation. And we have done this. We can undo it. And again, like I said before, we started the fire that is upsetting us. We put out the fire. We lose our fear of fire. And we don't have an enemy because, again, this has all been voluntary. We can prove it to you, chapter and verse, that you voluntarily signed these things. So, again, nobody's implemented this system but us. To complain about the system is confusing obfuscation of the contract itself. In other words, somebody did this to me. Somebody's doing this to me through the contract. Those evil persons, again, it's a division that doesn't really exist except in the contract, and then we're blaming the responsibility of my own signature on another party. Well, nobody did. It's not about, this wasn't about coercion. This was about a voluntary step that you took. It sounds abstract in thought, but it's very, we take this abstraction that we have in an open mind right now that we see as big. And I always remember the movie, I think it was Annie Hall, and Woody Allen's character in the movie had a conversation with Christopher Walken. the brother of his girlfriend. And the conversation went like Christopher Walken was crazy. And he was saying, I have this continuous dream where I'm driving down the street and it's raining and I just want to drive my car into this oncoming traffic. And so Woody Allen said, okay, that's a nice story, but I'm wanted back on planet Earth. You know, so he went back to have dinner and whatnot. But the next scene you saw in the movie was Christopher Walken driving them to the airport in the rain. We need to leave the planet Earth. Or in other words, we need to go pre-presumption. You and I in Jakarta right now are going pre-presumption. We're going, okay, I'm not the character in that contract. Just for a minute, just for an instant, to go back with us. And then say, okay, you did sign it voluntarily, and this is the problem that ensued with this. So with that open mind, we recognize together our power. We remember our own power that implemented the system that you think in the contract is your enemy, is not your enemy. You've created your own enemy.
A past guest, Dr. Paul Dobransky, would say observing ego. You know,
are you appearing to pose in the court is what they ask you, not pose, but they ask you, are you appearing as? And they say your capitalization of your name. So when you say yes, that is the straw man in the contract. So you're agreeing to the contract. So everything is about acquiescence. You're agreeing to it to begin with, and then you continue by collecting the paycheck and moving in form. You're agreeing to the system. So we understand there's a problem, and I think that's a great step. We're here talking about the problem. So I think this is the open mind that will heal the mind. And then we, like Jakarta and I always say, we read the contract, we implement the identity that we've accepted at this table, and then we know what the function is. I'm not going to entrap myself in debt that doesn't exist. So that you laugh at that. This is just a tiny, mad idea.
Jake Willis and Jakarta Zoe, if listeners want to reach out and contact you, how do they do that?
Well, the website is theartofknowing.com, and the telephone number is
866-766-0102.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for being on Another News. This has been very powerful, and I learned a lot.
We have too. Thanks for having us.
Thank you, sir.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. See you next week, Monday, 10 p.m.
To the memories of yesterday's clouds, I've been set free and I've been bound, and now I'm set free. I'm set free. I'm set free to find a new illusion. I've been blinded, but now I can see. What in the world has happened to me? The Prince of Stories who walks right by me. I'm set free. I'm set free. I'm set free to find a new illusion. Thank you. set free, and I've been bound. Let me tell you, people, what I found. Hey. I saw my head laughing, rolling on the ground, and now I'm set free. I'm set free. I'm set free.